Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Most people assume that healthcare is one arena where personal appeal doesn't help. If you're sick, you're sick. Turns out that's so 20th century. Lately, social media have been embraced as platforms for those seeking organ donations. Patients awaiting transplants have started making videos and launching Facebook campaigns petitioning for organ donors, bypassing long wait lists. And the thing is, it's working. In a recent blog post for The New Yorker, Dr. Daniela Lamas wrote that these social media campaigns are changing the organ transplant world and creating ethical dilemmas for doctors. She joins us by phone from Boston, where she is a fellow in critical care medicine at Massachusetts General Hospital. Welcome to the show.
Hello. Thank you.
So maybe let's refresh everybody's memory about the traditional method for deciding who gets an organ and when.
Sure. So when somebody is in need of an organ, there are two routes that the person can go through to receive an organ, and it kind of depends on what organ they need. So let's take kidneys, for instance. There are currently more than 120,000 people waiting for an organ transplant. A majority of these are waiting for kidney transplants. For a kidney, you can get on the transplant list. This list is arranged by a governmental organization, the United Network for Organ Sharing, which is an organization that has been tasked by the government with creating rules for the fair allocation of deceased organ donors. Someone dies, they're an organ donor, their kidney will go to the person on the list who is deemed in need and has, in the setting of kidneys, often been waiting the longest. So the person, their personality, their pleas don't play any role in the way these organs are allocated by the United Network for Organ Sharing. In the setting of kidneys, also in the setting of lobes of livers, and much less frequently in the setting of lobes of lungs, there's also a choice to have a living donor. Clearly, you can't have a living donor from an organ that one requires to stay alive. You can't have somebody give you a heart as a living donation. When it comes to living donors, the ball is really in the patient's court. Traditionally, doctors have said to patients who need kidneys most likely, you can wait on the United Network for Organ Sharing list. That wait could be 5 years, could be 8 years. Or do you have a friend or family who would be willing to give you one of their two kidneys, as they can live with only one? And it would be up to the patient then to answer, yes, I have a friend or family. No, I feel too funny asking them. And that distinction can really make the difference between a long wait list or a short wait list. But again, the living donor, that can only take place in the setting of an organ or a part of an organ that someone can live without.
Okay, so there's been two days. So switching to the Facebook, say, with your
right.
friends and quote unquote friends and family are connected, it's an efficient way to reach those friends and family. But with Facebook and social media, it's much more than that. Then it changes.
Indeed. So not only is it an efficient way to reach your friends and family, it also becomes an efficient way to, for lack of a better term, sell yourself. On Facebook, people get more views and more likes if there's something about them that's funny, that's popular, that's cool. And when the way to get a kidney creeps into that world, that's when it becomes ethically murky. People now can put up a campaign for themselves saying, you know, I am a father of three. I am a valued member of society. You, if you somehow get this link, should give your kidney to me because I am in some way that is perhaps overlapping but distinct from the details of medical need, I am deserving of your gift.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about using social media to, for some people, make it easier to acquire organs when they're in need of a transplant. All right. So has there been any kind of problem? I want to get to the physician's ethical dilemma, but I'm also wondering, has there been any problem with people offering to sell lobes of their liver or lung or whatever?
Yes, I spoke with a few patients who have put up Facebook campaigns for organs. These are specifically for kidneys. And in the setting of kidneys, they have received offers for kidneys with the request for money. This is illegal. They say that they then block the people from their Facebook page. But yes, if you open this up to the internet, there are definitely more than the possibility for problems. I mean, it's largely, they say, from different countries where there's, you know, more of a sort of tragic willingness to trade an organ for money. I do not know of any specific cases of someone having found a kidney or a liver lobe and then receiving money for it without actually sharing that with the transplant physician, because of course we can't know. I mean, if two
right.
people come together and say it's an altruistic donation, you can't, you know, you don't put them through a lie detector test to see if money really changed hands.
Mm-hmm.
So you can't tell. I mean, there's a one physician with whom I spoke, who's a transplant physician, who does not feel comfortable performing transplants on patients who come with a donor who they have found on Facebook or other social media sites. This is not a Facebook specific
issue. Is that one
issue.
Of the reasons why? Because they don't really know?
You just don't really know. And he
mm-hmm.
thinks that there is too much slippery slope. Yes.
It's hard to blame people when they think of going on Facebook or YouTube and making this pitch versus waiting maybe a fatally long time for something out of the regular system. Why? What is it about the regular system that can't compete somehow? Is it clear that it's just somebody's personality and good looks or whatever that's getting them this kind of feedback and getting the attention and then ultimately the organs?
No, that's not clear. And I agree with you. I think that people can't be blamed. I think the problem here is not that people are using tools at their disposal to advocate for themselves. There's, in my personal opinion, speaking as a human being and a physician, there's
mm-hmm.
nothing wrong with that. The problem that exists is that every 10 minutes, another name will be added to the National Organ Transplant waiting list, and 18 people will die each day from lack of available organs. How could I say that people should not use whatever tool is at their disposal? I think one problem is that, and this is something that there are a couple of sort of groups that are dealing with, is that our ways to encourage people to be organ donors are flawed. You know, it's a powerful statement that if someone can use Facebook to encourage another individual, an individual who doesn't even know them, to donate an organ, there is a great amount of untapped altruism there in the
mm-hmm.
world. And as physicians, I think that it is our job, rather than looking askance at this intersection between social media and medicine and saying, this makes me uncomfortable, thus I will back away, to say, all right, maybe this works better than the DMV. How can we use it? And there's a physician at Hopkins who I mentioned in my piece who is doing just that, who is saying maybe physicians can help people use Facebook to get organs.
It's interesting, DMV in Ohio, I just saw an article in the paper today, and I can't remember whether they're going to, I can't remember, but there's the routine of when you re-up your driver's license, they ask you, do you want to continue to be an organ donor? And they're going to stop that because apparently too many people are saying, I want to quit being an organ donor.
So interesting.
It is.
That's really interesting. I mean, there's a lot of people who make statements about the DMV being a uniquely bad place. It's a good place to get people in states where people drive, not in New York, for instance, but it's a place where people are hot and sweaty and they're annoyed, and there's some stranger who's made them wait in a long line asking if they were also willing to give their organs. It's
mm-hmm.
it's a really strange place to ask it. I can't think of a better option, but I think that these stories speak to the fact that there might be other ways to get people.
Well, and relying on the driver's license is assuming that every time somebody gives an organ, it'll be when they're not in a position to tell people themselves.
Right.
The whole issue of donating organs, living people donating organs, I don't know where anybody ever asks about that.
No, I mean, they don't. They don't ask about it unless you get an individual plea or, I suppose, see something on Facebook.
Mm-hmm.
And that would be interesting. Hard to think of where that would be asked and when.
Right.
But I think that would be something that would be interesting. You know, things that sort of this article has made me think about is whether someone would be comfortable being asked in the setting of a routine office visit with their physician, mm-hmm. whether they'd be an organ donor. There is so much packed into being an organ donor that there's almost never a good time to ask. But it's funny that the DMV asks and not your physician.
What does it involve to be an organ donor? Why don't we talk about that briefly anyway?
Sure. Are we talking about a living donor?
Yeah, a living donor.
Okay, so when we talk about living donors, living kidney donors are probably the best example because the risk to these people is lowest. The risk of donating a lobe of a liver or, say, a lobe of the lung is far greater, and it's a more extensive procedure. Risks of kidney donation are quoted as being similar to, say, getting your appendix out or other surgery that is in that vicinity of the body. It's a surgery, but people live well with one kidney. There have been studies sort of looking at the long-term outcomes and haven't found these to be, detrimental. Of course, I'm being vague because it definitely depends on the health of the person who is donating.
Mm-hmm.
Someone who is obese, who is in poor health, would be less of a good donor. And obviously, they have to go through an extensive array of testing themselves to make sure that the doctor, whose first job, of course, is to do no harm, is actually doing no harm to this healthy person by taking that organ, if that makes sense.
So it does. If you wanted to be a healthy, alive donor, where would you go to offer that up?
So you should go to your really local hospital. You should go to a hospital that performs organ donation, organ transplants.
Okay.
So and you can also contact your transplant center or your state organ donor bank is what I mean, which is something that is available online. Can also be found, I believe, through the United Network for Organ Sharing website. But I think one, although I'm not entirely certain of that, I think one great way would be to a hospital in your area that performs transplants and, say, I want to be an altruistic donor. That does exist.
Where do you see this trend going? Do you think there's going to be laws regulating how people find donors? Do you see some kind of control mechanism up ahead?
Yeah, so UNOS has considered these things. However, they are stopped by the fact that, and perhaps rightfully so, I mean, they're stopped by the fact that your organs, when you're alive, are your property. And you can't tell somebody that they can only donate to the first person on a list because, in my opinion, you're going to lose valuable donors. What I think is that physicians are going to have to become part of instead of against social media's sort of slow, not so slow entrance into medicine. And I think that things like this Hopkins physician who is trying to actually help patients use Facebook to find kidney donors, mm-hmm. I think that those are going to be what we will see more and more because otherwise it becomes something that is potentially dangerous. If you feel like you can't tell your physician this is where you found your kidney, well then that starts to imply that there's something wrong. And I think that that's where we will get into more ethically murky place than if we say this is open.
You also interviewed or wrote about a woman who, you know, just started doing this by chance and now has something like 60 people she helps post for and that kind of thing. Does she take money for that, or is that all altruistic on her part?
She's all altruistic on her part.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah.
But and so if somebody's saying, "Hey, I'll pay me and I'll whip up a Facebook page that'll make you look like $1 million or worth saving," that seems kind of creepy too.
Yes, that creeps into a more uncomfortable place, I think. Although, and that is exactly why
this
physician is trying to make. Yeah, and that's why these physicians are trying to say this is something that we're studying in a hospital academic setting. We're studying this is the information you give people. Exactly. And but you know, if we as physicians don't take it upon ourselves to do that, people will make it a business. I think that's a really good point.
Yeah, yeah. Well, thank you so much for joining us today to talk about it.
Oh, no, it's my pleasure. I think it's a really, really interesting, important topic.
That's Dr. Daniela Lamas. She's a fellow in critical care medicine at Massachusetts General Hospital in Boston. We'll post a link to her story or her blog post in The New Yorker on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. We'll be right back with more on Wellness Wednesday after this. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Each week we devote a segment to the Affordable Care Act. Today we're going to talk about the physician's role. If you have questions about the Affordable Care Act and how it'll affect your health care, you probably wouldn't ask your plumber or your mechanic. You probably would go to the source, right, and ask a doctor. But recent polls suggest that despite impending changes in patient coverage and in the way doctors are paid, physicians remain a little hazy on the details. Journalist David Nather recently wrote an article for Politico Pro outlining what doctors should know but don't about the Affordable Care Act. He joins us from Northern Virginia. Welcome, David.
Thanks for having me.
So what do we know about what they don't know? What have these surveys told us?
Well, these surveys have told us that there are a lot of doctors who have become pretty well informed about the law and how it works, but there are a lot of doctors who kind of don't understand the basics. The patients will ask them, like, you know, how do I get covered, and you know, how do the subsidies work, and this and that. But there are also doctors who don't seem to understand things that are going to affect them directly. Like there's an issue about people who get covered under Obamacare and are late paying their premiums, and there's a little bit of slack that's built into the law. But once they're like 2 to 3 months overdue, those insurers can stop paying their claims, which affects doctors directly. They won't get paid for their services, and a lot of doctors didn't know about that. It's buried in regulations, but it's something that they kind of need to know about.
Why do you think they know so little? I mean, most, particularly family physicians, these are very, very busy people. I can't imagine what more they can cram into their brains. But insurance is a big part of their world and has been for a long time. So why do you think they know so little? Whose job is it to educate them? Is someone not getting to them?
Well, you know, that's kind of the big question, isn't it? You know, it seems that in addition to, you know, not spreading the word about how Obamacare works to the regular public, the Obama administration hasn't been able to really educate all the physicians either. A lot of that work has fallen to the medical societies, and some of them are doing it and some aren't. I mean, you said it yourself, though. You know, doctors are busy. I mean, that's probably the best explanation of all. You know, a lot of them have taken the time to learn about this because they know it affects them. Some just haven't. Maybe they feel they're too busy to. Some of them are, you know, kind of falling for the ideological talking points, and they don't really get past that.
Joining us now is Dr. Randy Wexler. He's chair of the Ohio Association of Family Physicians and professor of family medicine at Ohio State University. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So we were just conjecturing about why physicians are falling into this category of not really, you know, this haziness category. What is your explanation?
Oh, I think there's really two, and I think the first one's already been touched on, which is just lack of time. Don't forget the ACA itself is thousands of pages long, written in very dry legalese, which is part of the problem.
But who would ever expect anybody to sit down and read the law?
Right.
Yeah.
The second one is we've been through a number of rounds of healthcare reform in the past that never happened. And I think there are some physicians who just think it's not going to happen this time. Therefore, why prepare for it, even though that's clearly not what's going on? It's here, it's happening, and it's continuing to progress.
In the state of Ohio, as I've driven through other states, I see how other states are handling the educational process just in general. Some states are really making a big deal out of it. Ohio is not. They're not doing practically any educating at all. Is that the same way? Does it differ between the states when it comes to physician knowledge?
I think it differs between the states, but it also differs between physician organizations. Mm-hmm. So the Ohio Academy of Family Physicians, for which I'm a member, has some educational components for physicians. At my department here at Ohio State, we're actually in the process of producing educational modules on the ACO type care, accountable care organizations, as well as patient-centered medical home through a HRSA grant that we will then be making available to individuals who wish to become more educated on some of the finer points and details of the law.
David Nather, can we talk about what the big changes are going to be for physicians coming up?
Yeah, absolutely. They're going to be affected by changes in payment and changes in the way there could be changes coming up in the way they're organized to deliver care. Like one of the biggest changes is that the law encourages the formation of things called accountable care organizations, which are basically networks of hospitals and physicians, or sometimes just networks of physicians that work together to deliver care more efficiently, and if they save money in the process, then they get to keep some of the savings. Now that's fine for heavily populated areas. It may be harder for physicians in more rural areas who kind of feel like, you know, they're missing the train if they don't get on board, but there aren't networks that they can join. There are other issues in terms of how they're paid. They're all part of a general trend to try to move away from fee for service, which is basically, you know, paying, you know, physicians and other healthcare providers for all the services that they perform, rather than, you know, say, you know, paying them for like one episode of care or paying them more to deliver care more efficiently. You know, those incentives are all going to be changing, and it's something that they really need to know about.
You're listening to All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the physician part of the equation, what they need to know going forward with Obamacare. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Dr. Wexler, Is that the case in Ohio? We have some very, very rural areas in Ohio and, six or seven major metropolitan areas, too.
Right. So one of the things we're trying to figure out is if we can use technology to kind of fill in those gaps. We typically talk about volume-based care, fee-for-service, changing to value-based care, which is what ACOs and PCMHs are. And to do that requires the delivery of team-based care, which includes physicians, nurse practitioners, dietitians, pharmacists, a number of other providers working together as a team to treat populations of patients. In some of the more rural areas, through Skype and other types of things, we're hoping to figure out ways to have dietitians, pharmacists, and other team members involved, even though they may not be there physically. Part of the problem, though, was already mentioned, is if you're joining an ACO, it's exactly who's going to go ahead and take care of that and putting that together. There are some groups looking at how to create such infrastructures here in Ohio, but there are a lot of ways to do it and a lot of people trying to figure out the best way to do so.
You know, a lot of times physicians have complained about the fact that it's the fee-for-service and not the overall general health care. But now that this might be changing or is changing, it's almost be careful what you wish for.
Right. Well, I think it's also the fear of the unknown.
And not knowing how to meet the requirements of the next generation of caregiving.
Correct. Because it's the unknown, and physicians do the same thing. They're very set in their routines. We treat people with certain conditions in very similar ways, and now that's being disrupted. And I think that's what a lot of people are concerned about, is not knowing.
David Nather, what about that, how they're going to measure these kinds of things?
Yeah, well, that's a question too. You know, they're starting to do some of this. Like, one measure is readmissions to hospitals. They're trying to cut down on that by having, you know, some penalty payments for patients who get readmitted if you have too many patients who are readmitted to the hospital.
It's a sign that something's not going right, maybe.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, do hospitals and physicians always have control over that? That's an issue. Do they have control? You know, are they practicing in areas where the health of the patients is lower than average? You know, there's some things you can control, like better discharge instructions so the patient don't have to come back. Some things you can't control, like if it's a less healthy population than average.
That's an interesting thing, because a lot of times, particularly older people, when they're referred out of a hospital, they're going into some kind of rehab situation. But the hospital doesn't necessarily have a relationship with those operations. Could that change, Dr. Wexler? Is that something that could change?
I think you will see that change, and that's what part of the whole intent behind an ACO is, that will then span the whole gamut of care from pre-hospitalization to hospitalization to post-hospitalization and back to the physician. I agree there are things that are frustrating for providers that we cannot control, and on the flip side, there are some things we could be better at. And I think transitions of care, which are the biggest problem, and the coordination of care, which is almost as big a problem, are things we can do much better at. And that includes the things that you've described here, which is going from a hospital to a nursing home and back into the regular population. An ACO, in theory, takes care of that because it works as an umbrella with all those organizations under one roof.
Cynthia in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show. Hi, Cynthia.
Hello.
Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, I didn't hear my name. Yeah, I had a question about the idea. I understand that certainly if somebody breaks a hip, you can tell 3 months later whether how well it's healing. But I had an HMO back in the 90s, and I would say that a fair number of my current health problems are things that were either not treated, untreated, treated very poorly, or in the short term.
Okay.
Because the doctor was getting, you know, highly compensated to not do anything. And so that's my concern with here. When you talk about compensating doctors by outcomes, what's to stop them from
not doing procedures that could count against them?
Right. And it might not be that it's going to make a difference in your health a month from now or 2 months from now. But 5 years from now, you have some part of your ankle or your knee completely taken apart that would have been a minor procedure.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Okay, let's get to David Nather. Any thoughts about that?
Yeah, that is a big question. I mean, the whole idea of all the payment changes that they're doing is to kind of cut down on wasted care and over-treatments and so forth, but you got to make sure that you don't cut out unnecessary treatments that, you know, that do cause more problems down the road. You know, that is something that they're going to have to figure out over time, and they've got to come up with the right measures to do it. I mean, there's some fairly simple things like don't overuse antibiotics, that kind of thing. But you do also have to make sure that, you know, because of these shifts in payment incentives, that you're not asking doctors to withhold necessary care. That's something I think we're not going to know for quite a few years down the road whether they've hit the right balance.
Cynthia, thanks a lot for that call. Dr. Wexler, from the family physician point of view, I'm wondering, is the same a typical scenario with the looking going forward, or is that something you're concerned about?
Well, that's something we want to watch and be careful about, and there's always that concern, especially if the wrong markers are chosen, whether a physician actually can impact or not impact it. There's some differences between now, though, and the late 90s. Mm-hmm. The late 90s were capitation. We're not talking about capitation currently, although that's likely where we will end up.
Capitation meaning?
Blanket sum of money regardless of how much care needs to be rendered to a patient.
Okay.
And now we're talking about blended payments, some fee for service, some care management, some capitation, some shared savings. So there's some differences there. The biggest difference is we actually now have electronic health records that allow us to mine data and control risk in a much better way than we did in the late 90s. And so I think a number of those things make this more actionable, but the concern always exists. Physicians talk about if I'm told that I have to get X number of my patients to a certain blood pressure level and I can't control them because they do different things, I may just have to remove them from my practice and ask them to go somewhere else. So it's important to strike the balance and have the right markers at the right levels. Otherwise, we could see some problems, and that's what we want to avoid. But I agree, that's going to take some time to play out.
There's a big role for primary care physicians in this new scenario, something we've gotten away from. I've gone around and asked a lot of people, who's your primary care physician? They don't have one. They have a dermatologist and they have a gynecologist and that sort of thing. Are you worried in Ohio about a shortage of primary care physicians that we've been hearing about?
Yeah, the Robert Graham Center, which is a research arm of the American Academy of Family Physicians, actually just recently came out with a projection that will be 661 physicians, or about 8%, almost 1 out of 10 physicians short by 2030.
Hmm.
Some of that's due to the ACA, some of it's due to the aging of the population, right. Some of it's just due to increased chronic disease. And so that's where we hope that patient-centered medical homes or team-based care, where working as a team you can care for more individuals, is going to at least help us bridge that gap to some degree.
And care for them over a longer span of their life.
Correct. Well, we already do that, but what we don't do a good job of is reaching out proactively.
Okay.
I might know how my diabetics who come in to see me are doing, but I've forgot about a diabetic who hasn't been in 18 months. And so in the future, I'll be looking at my list saying, hey, I haven't seen Mrs. Smith in 18 months. We need to give her a call and see how she's doing and get her in here. That's one of the primary differences of what's going on here, which is also called population management.
Nationwide, David Nather, any sense about the shortage, or how does the way Dr. Wexler describe it sound like how most regions are handling the situation?
Well, yeah, I mean, but there is concern about it nationally that there won't be a good enough supply, and actually, it's not all because of Obamacare.
Mm-hmm. Right.
It's not even the major factor, but some of it is due to that you know, if it's successful, you'll have all these newly insured patients trying to see doctors,
mm-hmm.
and there are some incentives in there to be able to train more primary care physicians and do something about the lower payments. For example, there's temporary relief from the really low payments that Medicaid gives to primary care physicians, for example, but it's temporary, it's going to go away, and I think the consensus is a lot more needs to be done to make sure that the supply is there.
Everybody I know who say goes into dermatology or whatever they go into, they say they do it because they're going to make more money. Dr. Wexler, what about incentives to bring people back to, primary physician days that we kind of grew up with, most of us?
Yeah, I think we're starting to get there. Certainly nowhere near where we need. Part of it is the reimbursement, the Medicaid to Medicare rates, which was just discussed. But correct, is only there for 2 years, and we're still not seeing yet here in Ohio, even though it began in January. But the other thing is loan forgiveness.
Mm.
When you have a medical student who has undergrad and medical school loans of $200,000, $250,000, then student loan forgiveness goes a long way in attracting individuals. I talk to students all the time who are interested in primary care but can't see a way out of debt if they do it. And so I think that's also one of the forgotten things with regards to helping student loan burden and then helping them choose primary care.
Gotcha. Well, Dr. Wexler, thanks for joining us today. We really appreciate it.
Thank you for your time.
It's Dr. Randy Wexler. He's chair of advocacy for the Ohio Association of Family Physicians. And David Nather, thanks to you as well.
Thanks so much for having me. And if you want to read more about these issues, you can read them at politico.com/Obamacare guide. It's our free guide to the law.
Sounds great. Well, thanks again. David Nather is a senior policy reporter at Politico. Pro. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. One in every 11 Americans suffers from internal crystals, a euphemism, in my opinion, for the crystallization of salts and minerals, otherwise known as kidney stones. Many people who have kidney stones never even realize it until it's too late, I suppose. They are so small, they pass out of the body during normal urination most of the time. But when a stone is larger than the urinary tract and becomes lodged, it's painful and responsible for about 500,000 hospital visits every year. Dr. Diane Gorgas, residency director of the Department of Emergency Medicine at the Wexner Medical Center, has seen her share of kidney stone cases. She joins us for Wellness Wednesday today to talk about them. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me, Ann.
So are kidney stones an indication that something else is possibly wrong?
Kidney stones are a salt imbalance on the body. And the interesting thing is we've been seeing a tremendous increase in the amount of kidney stones over the last couple of decades. To say that it's a true pathologic condition versus things that we are doing as a population to actually contribute to kidney stone formation is a tough balance, or it's a tough question to answer.
I mean, people can come in who are very, very physically fit, take very good care of themselves, and maybe they haven't hydrated enough.
Absolutely. And caffeine products certainly contribute to that. Lack of hydration contributes to that. A strong family history contributes to that. There are some pathophysiologic conditions like high blood pressure, especially when diuretics are used, that can cause more dehydration. Or obese patients are more likely to have kidney stones. Even diabetic patients are more likely to have kidney stones because of the dehydration that can be associated with chronically elevated blood glucose levels.
Okay, I'm not going to talk about my experience with kidney stones, but if anybody else out there wants to, give us a call. If you have a question for Dr. Gorgas, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Check out our Facebook page. That's a quick way to post a question or comment. But don't wait. We only have about, 12 or 13 minutes left. If you have a family history, meaning it's genetic, and you do everything right, could you still have a problem with kidney stones?
Yeah, absolutely. You can still have a problem with kidney stones. The difficult part of kidney stone formers are that the vast majority of kidney stones are calcium oxalate stones. It's a particular type of salt, and it's a salt that is precipitated within the kidneys by what we would consider a healthy diet. So some of the foods that are high in oxalic acid are leafy green vegetables.
The stuff you're telling us to eat.
The stuff that you need to eat for good health otherwise. And to really be on a diet that precludes all of those food groups is something that physicians in general will not recommend to you unless you have a history of chronic kidney stones.
So in some cases, since those are things with those kind of really dark leafy greens replace a lot of stuff that's lost from not eating meat, people who are on vegetarian diets sometimes aren't able to get they're eating too much of that and they have to abandon it.
Yes, that's exactly the case. And it's not only the leafy green vegetables, but almost every source of protein on a strict vegetarian or a vegan diet are at least moderate risk foods for the development of kidney stones. So soy and almonds and nuts and all of those things.
What a ripoff.
Yeah.
I'm so confused.
It's the only diet where we tell people to go eat fast food.
David in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Hi. I've heard the opposite, that meat and high saturated fat, things like that, causes more liver, gallbladder, kidney problems, and that getting away from that helps. And then also not eating, overeating is a problem.
Okay.
And then also, what are the alternatives? Instead of getting that ultrasound treatment for kidney stones.
You mean where they blast them?
Yeah. What's the alternatives? I've read different systems that clean the body without intrusive surgery and all that. And
okay.
I'd like to find out if the doctor knows it.
Diane Gorgas, first of all, when David mentioned he's heard the opposite about the diet, the saturated fat, you know,
Yeah, let me address that first.
Yeah.
And David, that's a great question. And frankly, it's one of those situations where the devil is in the details. Like I said earlier, the diet that helps prevent kidney stones can be deleterious to a number of other organ systems, including the liver, including the gallbladder, and also including other diseases of the kidney. If you have chronic kidney insufficiency or dysfunction of the kidneys, eating a high-protein diet is one of the worst things that you can do. So substituting some of your caloric intake to a protein-rich diet is going to be harmful to you. For kidney stones in particular, that is the rub, because that diet is unique amongst almost all the rest of the diets within medicine and is really not recommended for general health.
And then the overeating issue, you said there is an increased rate among obese people.
Yes.
So
statistically, there's an increased rate amongst obese people, and that may actually be tied to some minor extent in the fact that people that are obese tend to have less fluid intake than people that are thinner as well. So
okay.
It may be a link to dehydration.
Okay, and then there's either the urinary tract or blowing them up. Yay, or is there some alternative?
The hard thing with kidney stones is, actually, back when I was in medical school in the early 90s, we thought that we could develop drugs that would help dissolve kidney stones, and all of those drugs came to sad ends and that none of them seemed to be effective. So once you have a kidney stone, you have a kidney stone. The kidney stone is going to be there until the day you die, or until somebody removes it, or until you pass it spontaneously. Now, as you mentioned at the beginning of the show, Ann, a lot of kidney stones are small enough to pass spontaneously. But by the time that you get a stone that is greater than 2 or 3 millimeters, which is very small, almost all patients have symptoms when they pass that stone.
Can you give me an example, some context? How big is that? How big is, what do you mean? Like, is it the size of a sprinkle?
The tip of an unsharpened
on an ice cream
pencil.
Cone. The tip of an unsharpened pencil.
That's about 2 millimeters.
Wow, that's
right.
Small.
Right.
But it's,
so
it's
I
big
mean,
enough.
You sharpen the pencil, but it's not to a razor sharp
right.
point. That blunted tip of a pencil that you can write with is about
small,
2 millimeters.
But big enough to really hurt.
Really hurt.
David, thanks a lot for your call. If anyone else has a question about kidney stones, 614-292-8513. Is the hurt part the fact that they're jagged? We call them stones, and these are not river stones. These are they're crystals.
No, these are not pebbles. And I used to tell all of my patients that the hardest part about getting a kidney stone out was getting it down the ureter into the bladder. I have since been corrected by a number of my patients that it hurts just as much coming from the bladder to the outside world via the urethra.
Mm-hmm.
Especially my male patients tell mm-hmm. me that it is excruciating. Because they are. They're very jagged. They're very small, but they are not rounded edges. The larger they are, the more likely they're to be rounded. But most of them are relatively small and are painful throughout the entire urinary tract.
What are the signs? How do you know when it's a stone versus... What are stones often confused with, let's say, for the first-timers out there, when they're... having whether it's going through the urinary tract or whether it's going through the urethra, right? I mean,
yeah.
Whether it's coming in or going out, what are the different symptoms that may be confusing to people?
I used to be mystified when I was an inexperienced resident physician that the medics would come in and say, I got a kidney stone. And I'm like, how in the world would you know? But it is absolutely classic. You can see the kidney stone or the renal stone patient. They're somebody that can't sit still. They're trying to move to get to a comfortable position, which really helps us in medicine differentiate it from the other common causes of back pain, some of which are benign, like a pulled muscle in the back or back spasms, some of which are life-threatening, like aortic leaking or an aortic aneurysm, bleeding within the abdomen. All of those things can present as back pain. And even high up, you can get some heart issues that can present as back pain if you have upper back pain.
But with kidney stones, at first, maybe it's more of a back pain?
Most patients start with a back pain. There are a few places that kidney stones get stuck in the ureter. The most common place is right before the ureter makes almost like a little hairpin turn to empty into the bladder. Those patients will typically present with a lot of lower back pain. It may radiate to the front of their abdomen, and men, it actually may radiate into the scrotum as well. But it's usually when you feel kidney stone pain, not a lot of people have that insidious prodrome. Most people are fine 1 minute and taken to their knees, pale, white as a ghost, nauseated, frequently vomiting, diaphoretic, sweating, and just feel miserable. And they're writhing around trying to get in a comfortable position because of the pain.
Do some people have, is it the issue of the size of the stone? I mean, are pretty much our ureters, I'm getting all the ures mixed up, urethras, ureters, whatever, urinary tract. Are we pretty standard sized on that thing? Or do some people have smaller, and so the smaller stones will hurt them that won't hurt other people?
It's pretty much standard size.
Okay.
Now, a woman who's 4'10" and 90 pounds soaking wet versus a man who's close to 7 feet tall are going to have slightly different sized ureters. But they're pretty standard in size. And 2 to 3 millimeters is the size of a stone that the vast majority of people will feel. You can get stones up to 10 times that size. But most of the stones that we see that cause sudden onset of symptoms are anywhere between 2 and 6 millimeters.
Now, when something hurts that bad going through, when it's bringing you to your knees, you got to be thinking it's doing some damage on the way. Does it?
Damage, yes. Irreparable damage, if there's that much pain associated with it, actually the answer is usually no. So one of the tests that we look for kidney stones is evidence of blood in the urine. So you know that it's scraping or abrading the ureter as it comes down. But as long as a kidney stone passes, there is little chance for permanent kidney damage. It's those stones that get halfway down the ureters, get stuck, and cause backup of pressure into the kidney that can cause permanent kidney damage. And those are the ones we're very concerned about.
Okay. And some people, do they live with that kind of pain and ignore it and end up in front of you as well?
Some people do. Some people actually get to the point where they have kidney dysfunction.
How silly are they?
How silly is that? But I understand that it can happen. Yeah.
All right. And can calcium supplements be a problem?
For calcium oxalate stones, if you are on the high side of a normal calcium level, calcium supplements can be a problem. Anything that contains calcium, so dairy and...
And so if you're having a chronic problem, that's something a physician would check for?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. And sometimes people think it's a urinary tract infection. And some people have chronic urinary tract infection, so they just call up their doctor sometimes and say, I'm having another UTI, blah, blah, blah. That's not wise to do, or what?
By the time that you have a urinary tract infection that's actually giving you back pain, we're concerned as physicians or as healthcare professionals that it is more likely to be a kidney infection. I think that those type of infections, not just lower bladder infections, always require an office visit or an emergency department visit to diagnose.
And we'll take a quick call. Anne in Delaware, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, I just turned in late.
That's okay.
Is there a correlation to high cholesterol?
It's a great question, Anne. I haven't seen that as an independent variable. Hypertension, diabetes, those are patient populations that generally fight high cholesterol as well, but I haven't seen it isolated out as a predictor for kidney stones. Good question, Anne, though.
Thank you. Quick, what's the, you know, the basics as far as leading a lifestyle that will avoid kidney stones?
The best thing is to stay hydrated.
Okay.
There's an old axiom in environmental science, the solution to pollution is dilution. The solution to kidney stones is drinking at least 12 glasses of water a day. Any of the dietary changes, those really need to be directed very carefully by a physician.
And I know somebody who followed that, and they said, no, you're drinking too much water. It was an older person. And so, again, a lot of it, talk to your doctor.
Talk to your doctor. There's a lot of counterintuitive recipes for success if you have kidney stones that don't work for the general population. So talk to your doctor.
Well, Dr. Diane Gorgas, thanks for joining us again. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, Anne. It's always a pleasure.
Dr. Diane Gorgas, she's residency director of the Department of Emergency Medicine at the Wexner Medical Center. I want to thank the All Sides staff, producer Michael DeBonis, associate producer Amy Jurovich, assistant producer Rachel Quimby, production assistants Kiram Shaban, Julia Hyder, Andrew Zissler, and Leticia Wiggins, with video production by Rich Karsmitsky and Amber Karsmitsky. Alan DeCenzo is the composer of our theme music. WOSU News and Public Affairs Director Mike Thompson, Radio Operations Director Kevin Petrilla, Senior Broadcast Technician Eric French. Be sure to like All Sides on Facebook and follow the show on Twitter at WOSU All Sides. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. This is listener-supported WOSU 89.7 and WOSU HD1 Columbus, and streaming on the web at WOSU.org 89.7 NPR News. Your all-day NPR news station, a service of WOSU Public Media.